Good morning. We're looking again here at the issue of federal taxes for the week of March the 21st, 2016. And this week, we're going to have a number of things to talk about. We're going to start out looking at there are two different times we end up with blues over the Congress's explanation of the laws they passed. We also have a taxpayer who discovers that a penalty can be assessed against the taxpayer, even if the question of whether the taxpayer still owes any tax on a transaction has not yet been decided. The IRS responds to an inquiry for a private letter ruling request that helps explain how trusts deal with a deduction for charitable contributions, and the IRS yet again wields its favorite weapon to go against discounts claimed in a family-owned partnership, successfully getting those discounts taken away and the entire value included in the decedent's estate tax return. All of this coming up this week on Current Federal Taxes. Current Federal Taxes are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPE every week and your State Society of CPAs. Nichols Patrick CPE and the State Societies both are involved in the presentation of full-day CPE courses. One of the most important things you get in your continuing education is the value you should be getting out of those days. In fact, that's the major cost for a CPE course is not the cost of the course, but actually is simply the cost of your time being involved. So the key issue is to get value here. What your state society offers for you are full-day sessions in a number of complicated areas of tax law that go beyond the simple year-end update items we can cover, and give you the expertise you need when your clients come in with those strange and complex matters. So as soon as you finish up this year's tax season, which we know we've got another month to go, be sure to take a look at your state CPA Society catalogs to see what's been available here for training this year. Also remember, probably for many of you, we're coming up on dues renewal time. Not a bad time to remember, because these state societies are where you can be represented at your state legislature, who happen to come up with various neat and sometimes odd ideas about tax laws that need some input from experts who are CPAs, the members of your society. So be sure to support that when you get your chance. Now let's take a look at what we actually have this week in the area of taxes. And we're going to start out with our first development here, which is a Program Manager Technical Advice 2016-01. It was issued on February the 24th of 2016. And this particular Program Manager Technical Advice is the first of our two developments this week that look at congressional explanations of a tax law. In this case, the Joint Committee reports have indicated that Congress intended, when they retroactively increased the amount that you could pay somebody for transit benefits, you could pay an employee for transit benefits and exclude from their wages, that Congress intended for employers to be able to give checks to employees who had previously incurred expenses in excess of what they were able to be reimbursed by their employer for the transit passes, and that therefore these checks could be written in 2016, reimbursing these employees for that shortfall back in 15 or potentially even earlier years. The Joint Committee reports fairly clearly, as you'll see in the article on our website, describe that that's what Congress expected to do. But we have a little problem here. The problem we run into is Congress never actually changed the law to allow for cash payments. As the particular Program Manager Technical Advice notes, the law still says you can only make cash advances under very limited circumstances, none of which are allowed for catching up for prior years. So even if Congress intended to allow that, the problem is they forgot to pass a law to do it. A key issue when you're looking at congressional explanations of the law is they are useful primarily to resolve ambiguities. The problem in this case is the law is not ambiguous. It simply says you can't exclude any cash except those that meet very strict requirements, and those requirements are not making up for prior years where people incurred expenses. You have to have either a formal accountable plan, and even then you've got to have transit passes that are effectively not generally available to the public. There are all kinds of rules that get involved. Finally, as the IRS notes, the law also explicitly limits the total amount you could exclude any single month for an employee. And even if Congress had allowed for the cash makeup otherwise, that problem wasn't there. There's still the catch that you couldn't make up for all of the prior year without reducing what you could make for this year. Or in fact, you may not be able to make it all up simply because there's not enough room to make it up. So for all those reasons, the IRS concludes that despite employers who've read the committee reports and are thinking, well, we should be able to reimburse our employees and give them the cash, the IRS position is that can't be done. This tells us a lot about the limits, to be honest, of technical advice. Next up, our next issue comes in Private Letter Ruling 2016-11-002, issued on March the 11th, 2016. This relates to a charitable contribution being made by a trust. The trust in this case was the beneficiary of an IRA. The trust document said that that IRA money was to be paid over by the trust to a charity. Now, for whatever reason, the decedent did not leave the IRA directly to the charity, so we run into a little bit of a problem. The income is going to be income in respect of a decedent to the charity. So that's no question, or I should say not to the charity, but to the trust. So the trust has this income. For the trust not to pay tax on this income, it's got to be able to get a deduction for the payment made to the charity. Now we go back to take a look at that. As the trust notes, it's only, as the IRS notes, a trust is only allowed a deduction under Section 642C for a charitable contribution if two things are true. Number one, the payment must be authorized by the trust document. Well, in this case, that's pretty clear, and it makes perfect sense. The trustee has been told you are to pay this money over. So we clear the first hurdle, no problem. But the concern and what likely led to a request for the ruling here was that 642C also requires that the payment be made out of gross income. Income in a trust context is interesting because you have to be very careful what you mean by the word income. Income in a trust concept is, as anybody who studied trusts much at all remembers, is remember traditionally in trust we have principal and we have income. And we have this concept, therefore, of what's paid out of principal and items paid out of income. And your state's uniform, your state's version they adopted of the Uniform Principal and Income Act will have information about how you treat various cash receipts. And Principal and Income Act is very concerned with cash receipts. One of the interesting quirks is under the standard Uniform Principal and Income Act, an IRA distribution generally at most only consists 10% of income, 90% of principal, and that's only if it's a minimum required distribution. If the distribution is not required from the IRA, the entire balance is principal. Now that raises a question. Well, wait, this payment needs to come out of income, but we have no income, right? We maybe have 10% of the distribution as income. That's assuming we take only the minimum. And if we've taken the whole thing, then much less than 10% will represent the much less than 10% of it will be allowed as income because only 10% of the minimum is going to be allowed as income. So does that mean that we're just stuck paying all this tax? The answer is in this case, no, because you have to read carefully. Gross income, and that's the term allowed here, is a tax and not an accounting concept. Gross income is defined under Section 61 of the Internal Revenue Code. And the regulation that gives rise to this and interprets Section 642C specifically says it needs to be paid out of gross income of the estate or trust. Therefore, the IRA distribution, while it may not be income under the Uniform Principal and Income Act, is part of gross income of the trust for income tax purposes. Generally, when we're talking to the tax law about what would be Uniform Principal and Income Act income, you'll see the tax law or the IRS instructions as well refer to the concept as accounting income. This is not accounting income. This is gross income. And I realize those terms get confusing, but the question here is, was it paid out of gross income? Because of that, the IRS ruled in this case that the trust will be allowed a deduction for the payment made to the charity. Remember key issues. Now, a couple of other quirks about trust with charitable contribution. Remember, you might think, well, wait, what if this is the only income the trust has? Remember, individuals are limited to 50% of AGI. And as we all know, trusts have AGI, so are we in trouble there? Answer is no. Trusts are not subject to any percent of income limitation on a charitable contribution. As such, the trust is allowed to take all of its income and pay it out as a charitable contribution as long as it meets the two requirements of being authorized by the trust document and being paid out of gross income. If it's authorized under the trust document, including the implied trust document under trust law, and it's also part of gross income, then we get the deduction. Next up in our issue, Now we have the IRS comes back with a family limited partnership problem. This is the estate of Holiday versus Commissioner tax court memorandum decision, a tax court memorandum decision from this year that comes out and discusses how this works. That particular tax court memorandum decision came down this past week. Now, in this case with the estate of Holiday, the estate claimed partnership's assets that it funded a partnership should not be part of trust of the taxable estate of the trust. And it did this. It's a standard family limited partnership. The family limited partnership was founded by the decedent. She put marketable securities into the partnership. Now, this particular family limited partnership was not the majority of her assets, but it was significant. It was $6 million worth of assets went in there. Immediately after it was formed, the partnership had a very small percentage held by an LLC that was the managing, that was to be the general partner and managing partner, and then had the vast majority of it held by her. The value held by the small general partnership was about $6,000 in value, and her two sons bought those interests from her. She then went on and gifted remaining interests. Now the question becomes, generally, under these rules, we've got a simple rule. That is, as long as we have a gift, the partnership interest, because of the rules involving partnerships and valuations, generally you can't force somebody to be a partner with you. Because of that and because of lack of marketability and other rules, we can get significant discounts when it passes through the estate. But the IRS's favorite attack point, it comes under a provision of the tax law called Section 2036A. 2036A will yank all of the assets in the family limited partnership back into the decedent's estate if the IRS, basically, if we have two things. First thing that has to, for it to come back into 2036A, we has to show that the transfer she made was not part of a bona fide sale for full and adequate consideration. Generally, the way the courts have interpreted that and what's been the key aspects here, because they obviously had a sale for $6,000, fine. That was the initial formation of the partnership, and that's the key transaction we're going to look at first. Secondly, our question becomes, was it bona fide? To be bona fide, the courts have concentrated on whether there is a true, valid, non-tax reason for having entered into the transaction. It doesn't mean the tax reasons can't be a motivator, because they obviously are, but it does mean, is there a legitimate other goal being accomplished, or is this really solely a tax enterprise? If it's solely a tax enterprise, then the sale's not considered bona fide under the 2036A rules. But then the second issue is, even if that's not true, you still can escape it as long as she did not retain a life estate. Now, normally we don't draft our documents in such a way as saying, yeah, mom gets to use this for whatever mom wants for the rest of mom's life. We don't say mom has the right to grab any income out of here mom may need. So what the usual attack is going to be is that there was an implied life estate. Again, 2036A provides if she has the right to enjoyment of that income for her life, and there's an implied right for her to enjoy that income for her life, then it comes into her estate. Well, the IRS went after this particular enterprise on two counts. And unfortunately, the courts will agree with the IRS on both. First, on the question of whether it was bona fide. Unfortunately, a lot of partnership agreements have these long explanations that tell us, you know, all these reasons why we're forming it. And I say unfortunately because all too often it's pure boilerplate and nobody actually sat down and worried about this. And that came up at court. The estate tried to claim three reasons why it was a bona fide sale. And remember, if it's a bona fide sale, then we're safe. We're done. But the problem is we're going to end up losing bona fide. The first issue was here was, okay, was it bona fide? They said that, look, we are doing this to protect her assets because, you know, she might be sued. You know, there might be this nasty personal injury lawyer who's going to come after her because maybe somebody gets injured on her property. Maybe she drives her car and injured someone, you know, and there'll be this massive lawsuit against her. Well, the court said there were two problems with that. Number one, this lady was in a nursing home restricted there. So it wasn't as if she was hiring workers to work on her roof anytime soon or going to fall off. That was her example. Secondly, they pointed out she had never actually been sued in her life. And third, the vast majority of her assets were outside the partnership. So if there was this nasty personal injury attorney coming after her, there was still a lot of assets to go get. So they said, no, we don't believe that was a primary motivation. So the estate came up with option two. The estate claimed, well, okay, here's the catch. We want to preserve assets for the family. And that's also an often recited. We want to have centralized management, preserve assets for the family. The court rejected that as well. The court pointed out that the assets were already held in a trust where it could be centrally managed. There was no obvious problems managing the assets in the trust. They admitted that mom didn't really care if they kept everything together. Whatever the kids did, she was perfectly happy with the kids and the attorney. She had no input. Therefore, it did not appear it was a legitimate concern of mom to form this partnership to keep the assets together from her kids who would go, you know, basically expend them and burn them away. So now we're on to the third bona fide issue. This one was at least a little unique. They claim, well, we're trying to protect mom from undue influence by caregivers. And in this case, they pointed out that she had a cousin-in-law who had a caregiver that essentially held her hostage and threatened, you know, mom, the elderly cousin-in-law was by herself. The caregiver was necessary for her to be able to function. And she had no relatives. Her only relative was a grandson that lived 1,000 miles away. And the caregiver at one point threatened to leave and demanded $10,000 to come back. She demanded money from her. She demanded private jet trip to accompany them on a vacation with her family coming along. And they also said, look, we had another case where when the son's grandfathers died, that they discovered the caregiver had stolen a lot of family heirlooms. And they said, and finally, they also had a caregiver for this particular woman who had continued to bill them after she'd stopped working, and they caught this. Unfortunately, the court pointed out that, A, she wasn't like her cousin-in-law, who was probably the best case they had here. Her cousin-in-law, you know, she had the kids. Her kids visited her weekly. They were there in the area. She wasn't by herself and abandoned. She was in a nursing home where there wasn't a single caregiver who could do this type of exploitation. And they also noted that they never discussed this issue with mom, that they were putting assets in there for that purpose. So they said, no, we don't buy this as legit. So now we go on to, well, was there a retained life estate? Well, the partnership only made one distribution during the 2 years that it existed. This was despite the fact that the partnership had a provision that stated that it would make regular distributions, you know, after the general partners were to make a determination of how much was needed for operating cash and the excess cash was to be distributed. Now, here we run into a problem. Number one, they never distributed except for $35,000. And they admitted on the stand that they haven't really made such a computation and they thought that was mere boilerplate they put in there, but we were free to do whatever we wanted to do. Ignoring the partnership agreement is always a problem. The court found they did that. Secondly, the court also said it appeared that mom had a right to force a distribution, which suggests that she still had enjoyment of the assets that were in there. So if she needed money, she could have forced money out by invoking this clause. So for all those reasons, they said, sorry, this is part of her estate. Again, 2036A is a major problem that we have to watch out for when we deal with taxable estates. You need to be aware of the fact if you're establishing a family limited partnership, you've got to make sure the parties are aware of the need to fully respect the documents. You've got to make sure if you claim to have bona fides that real bona fides exist. And finally, you also need to make sure that the parties are willing to actually do all the work to keep the documentations and keep all the information together and be sure that, in fact, we'll be able to show that we respected the entity. In this case, they didn't appear to respect the entity. They kind of ignored the documentation and their recitation of reasons simply wasn't going to be good enough. We need to have a valid non-tax reason. And it's always nice to discuss it with the donor before we assume there's a valid reason, because that's the person that's going to need to have that valid reason for forming it, because that's the person who's changing the titling of the assets. Next up, We have another issue back to congressional explanations. This is a little more scary one out of here. Out of the general explanation of a legislation enacted in 2015, otherwise known as the Blue Book from the Joint Committee on Taxation, that was released on March 14th. The committee report in this particular case is explaining what Congress changed this year, and our major area of concern is dealing with the partnership exam rules that changed. The committee report talks in one section, as you may remember, a partnership with less that issues less than 100K ones and has partners who are not disqualified partners. So it has to have partners that meet that on our limited list of partners that can qualify. Now, that would include individuals and C-corps. That's no problem. And S-corps, so they're fine. But the question becomes, what about disregarded entities? Now, many commentators, after this law was passed back in November, had assumed that a single-member LLC that was disregarded or a grantor trust that's 100% grantor-owned, like a revocable living trust, well, those would be fine. They wouldn't cause us to be unable to opt out of the new partnership audit regime. However, the Blue Book suggests don't go so fast. First thing is, it has one example. These examples are in our written documents that you can download from the website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. It tells you specifically there that a single-member LLC would be a disqualified partner unless the IRS chooses in the regulations to allow single-member LLCs in. So the law itself doesn't protect, in the view of the Joint Committee, single-member LLCs. Also, the third example it gives of places the IRS could write rules talks about 100% grantor-owned trusts, and again suggests that a grantor trust will not automatically qualify. That includes revocable living trusts, which are very popular in much of the country as estate planning tools. And so if the partnership interest is held in the revocable living trust, as it almost certainly will be in many states, then those partnerships will have to be under the new audit regime. They can't opt out. This will all be true unless the IRS publishes regulations that specifically allow those entities to be part of the count. The other interesting aside is the examples also suggest that if we do allow them, they're going to each count as two. The single-member LLC would be one partner, and then the owner of the single-member LLC would be another if the IRS wrote that in. That could cause you problems if we're getting close to the 100, or frankly, if there's a whole bunch of these entities holding interest, that could even cause you problems as we get close to 50 partners. The likely justification for this: if you go back to the TEFRA partnership rules and Revenue Ruling 2004-88, the IRS had previously held that under the TEFRA rules, remember we had the small partnership rules that are somewhat similar, though they were automatic and they were much lower, number 10. But there the IRS ruled in Revenue Ruling 2004-88 that a single member LLC, even if it was held by a qualifying partner, would nevertheless cause the partnership to fall under the TEFRA rules. It would not be an eligible small partnership. That revenue ruling, which again goes back 12 years, is almost certainly what the Joint Committee was looking at when they said that the IRS would have to write regulations to let the other entities in. More importantly, which is probably of interest, is this indirectly means Congress has validated, shall we say, that particular revenue ruling on the TEFRA partnerships, because effectively they're saying, yeah, we agree with how that read the law. So be aware of that. Keep a close eye on these regulations. Finally, let's take a look at the case of, in this case, Vies Marketing. Vies Marketing versus United States. This is a pretty standard issue. The taxpayer in this case entered into a marketed welfare benefit plan. Under Section 6707A of the Internal Revenue Code, if you enter into a listed transaction or a transaction that is very similar to a listed transaction, you must file the Form 8886 with your return and every affected return. The IRS said this particular plan was like the plan described in Notice 9534, which is a listed transaction. Now, as always, promoters of these plans will tell you their plan is not like the one the IRS dislikes. And I'm sure this guy was told that the plan was not like the one the IRS dislikes. However, the court notes, the rule is simply, is it similar? And they said this is more than similar enough to be a transaction that we believe is a listed transaction. This was one of those quote unquote 10 or more employer welfare benefit plans where they assured you that you would always get your money and you were using it effectively to buy with pre-tax dollars long-term cash value life insurance that you would then go through a transaction and get out at a very low cost a couple of years down the line, giving you effectively deductible tax-free life insurance policy in your hand. Well, the court said you had to file those forms. Since 4 years had gone by where he hadn't filed them, the penalties added up to $10,000 per year. He triggered the minimum penalty each year, and that means that he owed $40,000. And the interesting aside to note, this is a disclosure issue only. The taxpayer is still disputing whether he owes any tax in the tax court. That case is still pending. It's irrelevant. The Seventh Circuit in this case, which is case number 152441 in the case of V's Marketing versus United States, the tax court held that that's nice, but you know what? Tough luck. The reality is that you had to give the disclosure. You didn't. Even if this is all legitimate, even if the promoter is correct that his plan is different and somehow meets all the requirements and he'll be fully allowed the deduction, which, by the way, hasn't happened, as I recall, in any of the cases we've seen yet, but maybe this one really is different. It doesn't matter. He still owes the $40,000, and the Seventh Circuit told him such. Okay, this has been the current federal tax developments here for the week of March the 21st, 2016. Be sure to listen to us next week. We're going to bring up, what goes on in the next week and how we're dealing with all of these neat things that we have coming up. So we'll talk about laws that change. You can also sign up there for an email of articles as they're posted to the website. Also, be sure to check your State Society of CPAs catalog for live continuing education purposes we mentioned earlier that are coming up. You'll be seeing those coming out here at the end of tax season. Be sure to join us next week when we'll take a look at more wonderful developments here in the area of federal taxes.